for inviting me. This is really nice. It's so nice to be in a place where you don't have to apologize for doing something useless like foundations. So I'm going to talk about quantum theory from the point of view of entropic inference. Hopefully, you won't hear the words quantum throughout the talk, eventually. Every now and then I'm going to cheat and say, oh, yeah, this is where H bar is coming in or something like that. But the idea is that I'm not going to start from a finite number of possible results or anything of the sort. I'm not going to have complex numbers. I'm not going to have anything of the sort. So just I have to be careful here because the self-destruct button is very close to the next slide. To introduce my topic, I'll quote a little bit from Wheeler. He said, talking about law without law, the only thing harder to understand than a law of a statistical origin would be a law that's not of a statistical origin, because then there would be no way for it or its progenitor principles to come into being. No tests of these views looks like being someday doable, nor more interesting and more instructive than a derivation of the structure of quantum theory. That's kind of interesting, the kind of stuff that we are trying to do today. No prediction lends itself to a more critical test than this, that every law of physics pushed to the extreme will be found to be statistical and approximate, not mathematically perfect and precise. And, let's just keep this, but the challenge of law without law, we can ask ourselves, is it not absolutely preposterous to put into a formula anything at first sight so vague? So the problem is, how do you put meat into the sandwich? How do you make it more reasonable? Let me quote also from James. This is a kind of, it's a beautiful picture, isn't it? it's all right. I'm sure that any one of you who has read the papers of Ed James can recognize his personality in that picture, all right? People swear to, I never met him, people swear to me that he was actually a nice guy when you talk to him. But I read him, and this is the picture that conveys his personality. Cranky. Anyway, here goes. Our present quantum mechanical formalism is a peculiar mixture describing in part realities in nature, in part incomplete human information about nature. This duality of reality and information about reality. All scrambled up by Heisenberg and Bohr into an omelette that nobody has seen how to unscramble. The proper tool for incorporating human information into science is simply probability theory. Not the currently taught random variable kind, but the original logical inference kind. For historical reasons, this is often called Bayesian inference. And it ought to be supplemented by the notion of information entropy. So this tells you where I'm going to be coming from. My talk is going to be, the way I look at all of these things, is going to be from the point of view of Bayesian inference. And of course, there's going to be a lot about the whole foundation is going to be based on the notions of information entropy. And that's why the whole objective is to derive quantum mechanics from the point of view of entropic inference. Completely Bayesian, though. So the big question that's going to permeate the whole thing. And then it's important to waste time on these things because you all of you have tried to give talks to a different audience and you don't know how they're going to bombard you, how they're going to misrepresent what you're trying to say. So one of the things that I'm going to, in a second I'm going to be saying is when I say the word information, beware, I'm not using the same word that you are hearing. And so be lenient there. Are the laws of physics laws of nature, or are they rules for processing information about nature? This is the ontology epistemology omelette that's difficult to untangle sometimes. The question in which, the way in which one would like to formulate this kind of problem is, okay, for the sake of argument, let's assume that the laws of physics were just rules for processing information. What would the laws of physics look like? It's a little bit like the old problem of You have the Earth going around the Sun. Okay, it's 1500, all right? The Earth is going around the Sun, or is it the Sun that's going around the Earth? It's a very difficult question. It's completely counterintuitive that the Earth is the one that's going around the Sun. The right question to ask is, well, just for the sake of argument, imagine that the Earth is going around the Sun. What would things look like? They would look like what we see. So it's a good way to proceed. In any way, what would the laws of physics look like if they were mere rules for processing information? So our objective is to derive quantum theory as an example of entropic inference. And we are going to see that the resulting formalism shows strong similarities to statistical mechanics. Of course, if you're using entropy to derive things, at some point, it's almost natural that it may look like statistical mechanics. The particular version of quantum mechanics that I'm going to end up getting is Nelson's stochastic mechanics. It's very similar to Nelson's stochastic mechanics. It's not quite it, but this is the form that's familiar. This is what's guided me. And quite remarkably, the approach shows conceptual similarities to general relativity. So I think that it's interesting. So let me start by telling you a couple of, this is a short version, a couple of slides on entropic inference. So let's start with what is information. So this is the goal of entropic inference. The goal is to update from old beliefs to new beliefs when new information becomes available. The fact that you have old beliefs, the prior probability distribution, going to new beliefs, the posterior probability distribution, this is what gives you a strong hint that I'm what you would call Bayesian. I hate this business of having to classify people as being Bayesian or frequentist or whatever, because the fact of the matter is that if you want a disagreement between Bayesians, all you need is two. You put two Bayesians in a room and you get a disagreement. So to call myself a Bayesian, right? I mean, we disagree with Chris. It doesn't take much, right? I'm an entropic Bayesian, which is another weird breed. It's a class of one, probably. In any case, but this is telling you, it's pointing to the fact that there is an update from old beliefs to new beliefs, from a prior probability to the posterior, when information becomes available. Okay, what is that? What we need is a thoroughly Bayesian account of what information might be. So here is a possibility. Information is whatever induced the change of beliefs. You learn something, you change your mind, your beliefs change. In fact, you're not allowed to change your beliefs from something to something else randomly. There are rules for doing these things. It's not a free-for-all. The information actually constrains what your new beliefs ought to be. The information is constraints on probability distributions. That is information. Please notice that I'm not measuring amount of information or anything else. I'm using the word information in very much the way you would use it in the streets. You ask a question, you receive information, you change your mind. In fact, this way of defining what something can actually be is very, very usual in physics. So, for example, an interesting analogy from mechanics that I enjoy is the following. Suppose you have a particle, and it is in a certain initial state of motion, and then something happens, and it changes its state of motion. Whatever it is that happened here, that is what you call a force. You define a force by in terms of its effects. So what I propose to do is define information in terms of its effects. You change your mind. That's whatever it is, right? Whatever information is. So force is whatever induces a change in motion. Information is whatever induces a change of rational beliefs. The word rational is there because I want to emphasize that it's not a free-for-all. While it is true that probabilities are to a large extent subjective, there is an incredible amount of constraints, information and consistency constraints, that does not allow you to hold whatever beliefs you want to have. Rational beliefs are heavily constrained. Okay, so how do you update from an initial state of beliefs to a final state of beliefs when information becomes available? This is what the method of maximum entropy is supposed to accomplish for you. And the idea is you introduce a quantity, relative entropy, here written both in a discrete version and in a continuous version. Those probability distributions that appear here are the prior. And so the idea is that you're going to maximize that relative entropy. Maximize because I have a minus sign there. Maximize relative entropy subject to the appropriate constraints, the information that is available. The justification of why you use this particular form of the entropy is a lengthy one. I'm not going to get into it right now, but I believe that is more or less a settled problem, although there is still an incredible amount of controversy as to whether you shouldn't be using other forms of entropy, like Zalis entropy or Reni entropy or whatever, other versions of entropy. I'm going to take the approach that this is the one. An interesting form of all of this is that the standard maximum entropy method that on the basis of which one derives the whole of statistical mechanics is contained here. It has to do with using prior probabilities that are uniform, reflect the postulate of equal a priori probabilities. And most interesting is that this mechanism for updating maximizes the entropy subject to the appropriate constraints. It also includes Bayes' rule as a special case. So it's an entropic inference allows you to process information in very, very general ways. This is what I'm going to be using. So now let me start with the physics of this. My whole goal in doing some of this is, of course, not just to derive quantum mechanics, but at some point I would like to also be able to derive general relativity or one wants to derive the whole of physics. All the laws of physics as processing information. So I'm going to do this in such a way that positions are particularly crucial. The observables that I'm really interested in are the positions of the particle. So here I have a particle that lives in three-dimensional Euclidean space. The version of quantum mechanics I'm going to be deriving is completely non-relativistic. And as such, you should expect me to make outrageous assumptions. You see, if I were to make extremely clean and beautiful assumptions and I derive non-relativistic quantum mechanics, then you know there is something deeply wrong, right? If I'm going to make extremely beautiful assumptions, I should be able to get the theory of the world, not a low-velocity approximation. So expect assumptions. I hope the assumptions will be very reasonable to you, but I wanted to realize that from the point of view of entropic inference, of fundamental principles of inference, energy conservation is not a clean assumption. It's something that you're bringing in from out of a hat, out of nowhere. So there are assumptions. In any case, the main assumption I'm going to be making throughout is that particles have a position, but that there is some sort of intrinsic uncertainty about that position. Somehow that particle the uncertainty of that, the position of that particle is going to be subject to some uncertainty. One possibility is that there are all sorts of weird things going on a more microscopic scale that are bumping the particle around. Another possibility is that the space that I'm thinking here of as being a three-dimensional Euclidean space is actually some sort of approximation to something that is like a space foam or something, whatever. Whatever the origin of this uncertainty, there is a probability distribution so that when I say that the state of the particle is X, what I mean is that the actual location of the particle, the actual location Y, is somewhere in the vicinity of that X. The state of the particle then is X. The actual, so here I'm writing the same thing again, there is a probability distribution, and what I'm going to now start thinking about is the space of those probability distributions that are labeled by X. So, yes?
So what do you mean? I mean, well, it's sort of a philosophical question, but it might be relevant. Are you assuming the particle has a definite position with ontological validity?
Yes. Actually, what I'm saying is that the particle might have a position Y, but I am uncertain about it. The best I can do is tell you what the probability distribution of those Ys are.
I know, but I'm confused about what that means.
Does it make a difference if instead of saying you're talking about results of experiments instead of actual positions
Okay, then we may, okay, maybe I can formulate your question like this. If I were to measure position, what do I measure? Do I measure the Y?
Yes, Y.
Okay. It's going to end up not mattering very much because the idea is going to be that whatever, and whatever this space, real physical space, whatever that might be, whatever that is, the space that I'm going to be more concerned about is this space of probability distributions. I'm going to call this configuration space. And I'm going to be always thinking about the fact that this probability distribution, whatever it is, it's very narrow. So it's very, very tiny. So when you say I perform an experiment, and you say, well, you perform an experiment, you measure a Y. Yeah, but look, this is so narrow here that the language I'm going to use is, well, I perform an experiment and I have certain ideas about the value of X. The probability distribution is so narrow that, for all intents and purposes, X and Y are very, very close together. Okay. Y would be the actual positions in this physical space. Unfortunately, the positions Y cannot be known precisely. The best I can do is know a sharp probability distribution of those Ys. And that probability distribution is labeled by the average, the expectation.
The expectation
of the Ys, yes. So I could go ahead in the spirit of statistical mechanics and call these Ys the microstates. A what?
What you described is almost by definition a hidden variable.
Oh, of course. These are all like hidden variables. Yes. Yes.
It's not really hidden because you measure Y and you obtain a value of Y. Then you repeat the measurement, you obtain the
value. Hidden variables are funny sort of words, but in the sense of if you... Is it hidden? In the sense of the stochastic mechanics of Nelson or the Bohm guiding wave theory, there are hidden variables there too. It's in that sense, yes, they are hidden variables. But of course, it's position. So these Ys, I'm going to call those the microstates, and the Xs, which is a probability distribution, I'm going to call those the mesostates. This could correspond to a thermodynamic state of given temperature and pressure or something like that. the fact that I have microstates and mesostates sort of hints that there will be macrostates coming into the picture later.
Mesostates are a collection of
possibilities. The space of mesostates, one mesostate is one of these probability distributions. It's one point on that space. So that point that you see there is a little probability distribution like so. Each point here, each point there, corresponds to a probability distribution down there. Now, the whole discussion is going to end up happening in this space here. The wave function that I'm going to get eventually, psi of x, is going to be a wave function defined on this space there. On x, the configuration space. So now that I have probabilities, let me talk about these probabilities a little bit. Let me talk about the space of probabilities here. The configuration space X. Each point on that space represents a probability distribution. I have to make statistical model about what these probability distributions are. I'm going to assume that they're spherically symmetric Gaussians. Why do I have to make such assumptions? Well, you see, the problem with a set of rules of inference that involves maybe Bayes' theorem, probabilities, entropy, and all that, the problem with a set of rules for inference, for processing information, is that it applies equally well to quantum mechanics and also to the stock market and to clinical trials and so on, right? And so somewhere in this discussion here, I have to tell you, I'm using entropy, and I'm using probabilities, and I may be using Bayes' theorem and all of those things, but I have to tell you, I'm not doing the stock market, okay? So this is the place where I'm telling you I'm not doing the stock market. I'm talking about positions of a particle, and the positions are going to be spherically symmetric Gaussians. Why is it reasonable to assume Gaussians? Well, if it turns out to be the case that the reason for these uncertainties have to do with microscopic stuff that is inaccessible to us, then all sorts of central limit theorems tell you that, well, you know what, if you have a bunch of little things bumping into the particle, it's not unusual that you're going to get a probability distribution that is a Gaussian, right? That's the only justification I have for these Gaussians. It turns out being fairly convenient. Oh, okay. Good. What do we have here? I'm talking about one particle, three dimensions. So these indices here, delta A goes 1 to 3. We can see that it's a Gaussian, right? X is the expected value. There is sigma squared, is some sort of uncertainty, the variance. But please notice, this is modulated by a function capital phi, so that the uncertainty of position of the particle in one place need not be the same as the uncertainty everywhere else. That's why this space here was written as being a curved space. Had I written this uncertainty, the variance of these Gaussians, as being uniform, I would have gotten a flat space like the one we see down here. When you allow that uncertainty to be modulated from place to place, then you have a much more richer geometry. You can have curved spaces.
So it's still the case that at any given point,
yes,
you allow one particular.
Yes. Yes. Okay, so here we go. Spherically symmetric Gaussians, here we go. There is a variance. The variance is, the idea is going to be very, very sharp, and it's modulated. And now, I'm doing this for a single particle, but you can actually see that it's very easy to generalize this for like two particles. You just make your index, instead of going 1, 2, 3, you can make it go all the way to 6, and you can do exactly the same sort of thing for any number of particles. You can definitely have this X here be in 6 dimensions, and so that the modulating function that you have here is going to depend, the phi for one particle will depend on what's going on with the other particle as well. And so all aspects of non-locality are being put here in through the fact that I'm talking about configuration space from the beginning. All right. What else can we say about these things here? Each point x represents a probability distribution. There are Gaussians. Now, the crucial. A point in that configuration space is not just a dot. Euclid would have said a dot, a point, is that which has no size. Well, these points here have a lot of structure. They are probability distributions. The configuration space is a statistical manifold, which just means that it is a space of probability distributions, right? But amazingly enough, this also means that on this statistical manifold, there is a natural measure of distance. There is a natural metric. The metric on this space is unique. There is only one form of metric on this space, on this configuration space, that properly takes into account the fact that the points are actually themselves probability distributions. The information metric, the metric of Fisher and Rao, can be written in a very nice way in terms of relative entropy. If I write the relative entropy of one Gaussian located at x plus delta x relative to another Gaussian located at x, two neighboring Gaussians, I compute what that probability distribution, that relative entropy is. I compute the second order. The second order term actually has all the properties you may want from a metric. In fact, it's the metric. So when you actually compute that for Gaussians, plug in those Gaussians there, and you get a formula. And in the limit in which sigma, when sigma is sufficiently narrow, the form you get for the metric tensor is very simple. So this is very nice about an interesting fact about Gaussians. If you have a Gaussian and you have the variance-covariance matrix that appears here in front, what you're going to have is something that this is going to be the metric in the space of those Gaussians. So it's very easy to read what the metric tensor looks in the space of Gaussians. It's essentially the Euclidean metric, which is this, maybe with a scale factor, and then modulated by a conformal factor that tells you how the various uncertainties change over space. Once you have a metric, you also have measure of volumes. So the volume element is just going to be, just take the determinant of this little monster here and proceed. It's a positive definite metric, so it's all of this is nicely defined. Yes? Oh, this is how it works. When you substitute that Gaussian here, you get additional terms. When sigma is very narrow so that your probability distributions are very, very nice and sharp, then all those terms can be neglected. Okay, when I want to do general relativity using ideas of this kind, of course, the first thing I want to do is see, can I get Einstein's equations? And can I do things when the curvatures are not too extreme? But it's very clear that if any approach like this is ever going to work in gravity, then whenever you're close to a singularity, then all sorts of additional terms are going to have to be included as well. This is not relativistic, So the spaces that I'm going to be considering are pretty nice and smooth, and I hope. This is only about a couple of months old, so I'm still making all possible mistakes. I'm at that stage when I haven't exhausted the number of silly mistakes. Okay, so now that we have the space that we're going to be talking about, this particle is in a state x in some configuration space, how does it move? The idea is going to be the particle moves from one point to a neighboring one, from one state to a neighboring one, from one of those little Gaussians to another one little Gaussian. And this is where some of the tricks of inference come in. Just because we're talking about this configuration space X doesn't mean that That is the relevant space for the purposes of discussion. You see, neither the new state nor the new position are known. I know the X, the initial X. I want, and it's going to jump to a final X prime. But the truth is, I have no idea what X prime is, and I have no idea what the Y prime is. What is the associated one? I have no idea. The relevant space is the product. This is a crucial element. And what that means is that what we need is the joint distribution of X prime and Y prime. And I'm going to obtain that joint distribution by maximizing the following relative entropy, which is the space, the relative entropy in the product space. Here we have a prior. Here we have the possible posteriors. The crucial idea in an entropic inference problem is, what is the prior? And what are the constraints that I'm going to impose on the posterior? And this is going to tell me how I move. So here we start. There is the relative entropy. I'm going to be talking first about the prior. We can always write the prior, the joint distribution, as being the probability of the first times the probability of the second given the first, the product rule. You can always do that. Now, let me look at this guy here first. What's the, before I know anything, what can I say about the probability of where the new position is going to be? That's the best I can do. I have no idea. So I'm going to take it to be uniform. Uniform means it's going to be proportional to the volume element. If you take a volume element that's twice as big, you get twice as much probability. So it's going to be proportional to that determinant of the Fisher metric. Now, how about the Y? What is the distribution of the Ys? Well, before I know anything, and this is crucial, right? I'm trying to codify into this prior ignorance. Before I know how Y is connected to X, I know nothing. So I'm going to represent this prior by saying, look, I know nothing about where the particle is going to land in X, and I have absolutely no idea about how Y is connected to X. I'm going to take it uniform. Why uniform? It's the metric that you would put there for the flat Y space. So just uniform. That's my prior. Oh, because I don't know that yet. You see, this is the crucial thing. When I talk in this business of entropic inference, in updating from old beliefs to new beliefs, the idea is, what are your old beliefs about where the particle is going to go? I don't know. So I'm at that level. I don't know. I don't know yet. I'm ignorant. So now, next step. Ah, but wait a minute. I do know that the Y prime ought to be connected with X prime in some way. That's my first constraint. This is where I put the information in. In this business of Bayesian inference in general, the crucial, difficult step is not to know what the information coming in is. It's data or some constraint like expected value of the energies. That's the easy part. The difficult part is always, what did you know when you were completely ignorant? Before that, can you separate that and achieve that state of ignorance? Okay, this is the state of ignorance here. When I don't know how these guys are connected, I know that for the initial position, the Y and the X are connected by a Gaussian, but I don't know that for the final position yet. I don't know. So now I have to put it as information. I can always separate this using the product rule, and I'm going to say that the conditional probability of Y prime, the new real position given the X prime, is going to be one of those little Gaussians. That's where the Gaussian comes in. This is the piece of information that tells you how the Ys and the Xs are connected. Before we do that, and what is this guy here? This is the probability of having started in X, ending up in X prime. This is the object we want to compute. This is the probability of a step. This is where the dynamics comes in. There is another thing that I want to impose in this, which is the fact that when a particle ends up moving around in this space, it's not going to jump discontinuously to a faraway point. So I want to somewhere in all of this put the piece of information that when you go from x to x prime, the x prime is close to the initial x. That second constraint is going to be implemented by saying, well, remember, remember that the relative entropy is a measure of the distance. Well, I'm just going to impose that the expected value of the relative entropy, the expected value of the relative of the distance squared, is some small number. So I'm going to say, well, I know that the particle moves a certain amount, but it's a short step. I'm sorry? It's going to end up being, yes, yes. The particle it has a certain probability to move, and it can't move very far away. So yes, it does end up being a Brownian motion. It's a little bit more primitive than a Brownian motion at this point, because there is no notion of time yet. Oh, that has to appear. Yes, yes, yes. Eventually, all of these things are going to have units. Let me see. The interesting thing is that at this point in the calculation, I don't have to tell you that it is short. It's going to be short in a little while. But at this point, from the point of view of the entropic inference problem, I have one constraint. This I'm going to plug in here. And I have a second constraint that tells me that the expected value of the size of a step is a certain number. And I plug it in. Short compared to what will become clear in a second.
Okay, but have you used short in that?
Oh, no, you don't have to. No, not yet. Just let me do this and proceed. And then I'll show you where it is that this is going to be short. There was another question.
The number.
The truth is that I don't know that number. This is an interesting subtle point in entropic inference, that sometimes you know that a piece of information is very relevant to your calculation, and you would like to include it as a constraint, a piece of number. For example, in statistical mechanics, you may want to maximize an entropy subject to a constraint on the expected value of the energy. Right? And what you obtain is the Boltzmann distribution. Now, the interesting thing about that sort of calculation is that nobody ever knows the expected value of the energy. What you do know is that the expected value of the energy is relevant information, important information that you ought to have if you want to actually constrain your probability distributions appropriately. What I'm saying here is that the fact that the steps satisfy a constraint on the expected value of their size is relevant information. In a little while, I'm going to actually address the issue of, okay, how big are they? What big or small or relative to what? Here I'm saying this is important information, and what I want is probability distributions that codify this sort of information.
Why don't you have some other constraints then? I mean, the more constraints you have,
Yes. Okay.
Unknown number.
If you could consider having more constraints, and what you would have to argue is that for the purposes of the analysis of that particular system that you're interested in, those constraints are actually information that you ought to have if you want to make good predictions.
This is a kind of placeholder for a constraint?
You could call it like that. I recognize that knowing that the particle doesn't move by these continuous steps arbitrarily far away, I recognize that that is information that I ought to have if I want to describe physics. And I'm going to I'm going to allow myself the possibility of keeping that information available in there.
But the thing is that under first constraint, you've written an actual constraint.
Yes.
And under second constraint, you've written what looks to me like a definition with some extra words that you say don't matter now.
So no, okay. It is a constraint in that I'm telling you the following. For any for any function that you put there, this is a constraint. The expected value of this relative entropy. I'm giving you a family of possible constraints, okay? And I'm going to later decide which are the actual constraint that is important for me. You see, this is the expected value. Let me see. Where is this relative entropy? Here. This relative entropy. This is the relative entropy. It happens to be a function of x and x prime. And here I am averaging over the px prime. I'm averaging with this probability distribution, x prime, averaging over that. X is fixed for this particular state. I'm averaging over the possible x prime.
Okay, so it's over
the p of x prime. Yes. Which amounts to just saying I'm averaging over this guy here. And now I put it there. I average, I implement this constraint. It's easy to implement, just substitute. This constraint requires a little bit more massaging it. You have to introduce Lagrange multipliers. And so the result is going to be the probability distribution for the jump from x to x prime is going to include the volume element. This is what makes this a density. Then the exponential of the entropy of those Gaussians. It's just a matter of doing it. There is a Lagrange multiplier, and this is the relative entropy. The actual value of that expected value is now hidden in this Lagrange multiplier. Well, that is the entropy. Now, okay, so what is the dynamics that is implicit in this sort of idea? The dynamics is going to be one in which if you start at any point x, the probability of jumping to an x prime is essentially going to be given by the exponential of the entropy. You're going to try to move in directions in which the entropy increases. The entropy of those little Gaussians is increasing. You try to move to locations where those Gaussians are a little bit far. But you see, there is this minus multiplier, and then this is the distance. But you're not going to move very far away. You can't move. Far away means you're going to kill that probability. The probability is going to be like sort of centered around x in the direction of increasing entropy. When alpha is large, and now you can actually see what alpha being large means. It's, of course, relative to all the other terms that appear in the exponent. Then this function here ends up being a Gaussian. The small displacement from x to x prime is centered about an x, its mean value, with an uncertainty that is given, a various covariance matrix that's given by that amount. I'm going to come back in a little while, talk more about what these expected values are, how you drift, and what those uncertainties are. But the idea then is the following. As a result of this, there is a space that I'm no longer be very much worried about. I'm just talking about the dynamics in this configuration space. You have an x, and you're going to jump to an x prime. But what the law of jumping gives me is actually a probability distribution. So eventually, this thing is going to diffuse in various ways. And so there will be, after a while, after you accumulate a few of these short steps, there's going to be a probability distribution drifting in the direction of higher entropy. So now we have the original physical space, the microstates. We have this configuration space, the mesostates, the Gaussians. Each point there is a Gaussian. And We also now have something that resembles a macro state, a probability distribution over the various axes that appear there. Those are what's going to eventually appear as the Hilbert space. So the Hilbert space is going to have to do with probability distributions over the configuration space.
The macro space are basically meta probability, the probability of probability.
Yes. Yes. So now we have to introduce a notion of time here. I went very quickly when I said that. Oh, yes, and you accumulate many short steps. Accumulating short steps is not so easy. You have to do a lot of bookkeeping. So time is going to be introduced by looking at dynamics. The foundation of any notion of time is to be found in dynamics. And it's going to be introduced as a device to keep track of this accumulation of many, many small changes. So now the idea is the following. What I want is I want to find the probability of, you know, let me go back to here. One of the amazing things about, or one of the things that happens with this probability distribution is that you go from an x to an x prime, and then from the x prime to an x double prime, and so on. After a while, you don't know what the x triple prime is, and you don't know what the x double prime is. You have probability distributions for all of those. So you're not just uncertain about the final position. You're also uncertain about the initial position. So that's what I want to talk about here. The real probability distribution that we want to discuss is going to be the joint probability distribution. And from that, we can construct the marginal, the probability distribution of the second step. And we can rewrite it like this, the probability of being at x, and once you are in x, jump to x prime. This guy here we know. It's the one that describes the whole dynamics. We've already figured that out. Now, this is following the rules of probability theory, product rules. There is nothing here that has anything to do with the notion of time. This applies equally well to the stock market or to clinical trials, the future, the past, whatever. So I'm going to make an assumption here. Somewhere in this whole development, I'm going to have to tell you, and in this model, this is time. I'm doing it here. I'm going to introduce the notion of an instant. The idea is going to be that if all of those possible x's occur at one instant, when I take a step, then all of those x primes will occur at the next instant. So if all of those x's occur at a certain instant of time, then as I take a step, all of those x primes will occur at the next instant of time. This is highly non-trivial, okay? This is where some of the physics of time is being hidden. The idea here is going to be that if I go from one instant to the next, and then from that one to the next, I can construct time as a sequence of instants. Each instant is represented by a probability distribution on the configuration space. So we have time introduced in a way that you satisfy that equation. And we have to figure out what the interval of time is between successive instants. Well, the interval of time, whether you go more time or less time, has to do with the dynamics with that. Yes, there was a question there somewhere. No? It has to do with the dynamics. So I'm going to introduce a notion of what is the interval from one instant to the next in such a way as to simplify the dynamics. This is where Newtonian time is going to start coming in. For alpha large or short steps, I can take that original probability distribution and approximate it as a Gaussian. And so I'm going to define time so that motion looks simple. Typically, you want time to be such that, if you want to define Newtonian time, such that if you take a step here, this is a delta t. If you take a step there, that's also a delta t. You don't want delta t's different places. All right? It's not relativistic. So we're going to define time so that the delta t is inversely proportional to the actual length of the steps. And also to the, well, there. So define time so that motion looks simple. I'm going to choose my alpha. Choose my alpha so that this is actually true. It's the product of those two is inversely proportional to the interval of time. Tau just sets the units of time. So this is where part of what your question had been, okay, how do you choose these expected values of the lengths of the steps? Well, this is what the dynamics is going to be. I'm going to choose it in such a way that it provides you with a simple dynamics. Move little steps. The smaller you take your intervals, your instants in time, the bigger you're going to take those alphas, and the shorter the steps are going to be. It's completely, yes. Time is defined so that motion looks simple. But once we have it defined in this way, the result is a nice Wiener process where the actual displacement, the delta x that you obtain, the displacement that you get there, are going to be given by some average. The average is what appears there. The drift velocity is going to be given, once you compute what those Gaussians look like, the drift velocity is given by the gradient of the entropy. So the particle, the average displacement of the particle is really in the direction of increasing gradient of the entropy. This is the first interesting result. In Nelson's mechanics, he actually has to say that those velocities of his in the stochastic mechanics are actually given by the gradient of a function. Here, it appears naturally that it's going to be the gradient of an entropy. The particle moves in the direction of increasing entropy. Then there are also fluctuations. So you have an average displacement, and there are fluctuations around it. And the fluctuations are going to be given by something like that, proportional to delta t, so that the actual size of the fluctuations is proportional to delta t to the 1/2, which means that the trajectory is going to be really like a Brownian motion, and it's continuous, but not differentiable.
The
delta t's are going to be the same for different x's. I am defining the length of the steps in such a way that the alphas is defined in such a way that you have this probability distribution, so the particle could be here or could be there, and if you're here, you jump that much. If you're here, you jump that much. The lengths can be different, but the delta t is going to be the same.
So you fix t, and then let's decide the shape of the form of alpha and what was t.
Yes.
Y.
Yes. Yes.
On x.
Yes. I imagine that once you proceed doing this, it might be possible to do that. But I've never tried doing anything like that. Okay, yes, yes. So the short answer is yes. Yes, you could construct a foliation in that way. It's going to get a little bit more interesting in a second, because as you probably realize, what I am describing here is a regular diffusion process. There is nothing to do with quantum mechanics here. An interesting feature of this, however, is the following. If you ask, this velocity here is the future drift. If you're given that you're here, where are you going to be found? The average gives you what's called the future drift. There is also something called the backward drift, which answers the question of, given that you're here, where did you come from, right? So there is the where are you going to on the average, and where did you come from on the average, and the two need not match. The velocity to the future, the average velocity to the future, and the average velocity from the past need not match. What that indicates, and here is the formula that allows you to compute one, this is from the past to the future, there is a difference, is that there is an irreversibility in this process. And indeed, there is, the whole thing was obtained by maximizing entropy. You shouldn't be surprised to find that there is irreversibility in this. What's actually kind of interesting is that the actual relation between the two is a very nice and simple exercise in Bayes theorem. So Bayes theorem enters in deriving this formula there. Once you have a nice Wiener process, you can actually write down a Fokker-Planck equation and figure out how that rho actually diffuses as a function of time. Here we have the uncertainty, units of time, and we have a nice Fokker-Planck equation. You can also find a continuity equation. The probabilities are conserved, and there is a current velocity. The current velocity turns out to be the average of the backward and forward drifts, and you can compute it, and it ends up being the gradient of something. That current velocity is the gradient of, except for constants, the entropy of those Gaussians and the log of the probability density. There is also another kind of velocity that you can define here, which is what in normal diffusion is known as the osmotic velocity, which has to do with the difference of the back and forth drift, and it has to do with the gradient of the log rho. So there are two interesting velocities in this problem, the forward drift and backward drift, or analogously, equivalently, the current velocity, the velocity that appears in the continuity equation, and the osmotic velocity, which is the difference. Yeah. No? Okay. Oh, I think I'm almost done. I'm lying. In any case, look here again. Nelson, in his stochastic mechanics, had to make an assumption that this velocity is the gradient of something. Here it appears naturally. But this is just diffusion. It's not quantum mechanics. If you want to have quantum mechanics, you need 2 degrees of freedom. You need the density, and you need a phase. But you see, when we talk about this sort of scheme and diffusion and this configuration space, and imagine for the sake of argument that you were talking about that phi that appears in the current velocity as being a phase. Is this a good phase? It's a phi. It's a function. But look, it's not a separate degree of freedom from rho. Here we have rho, so as far as this guy goes, it's the same degree of freedom as you have there. And the entropy is the entropy of the probability distribution at each x here. It's a prescribed field. So this is not an independent degree of freedom. No, that's not a good phase. We don't have quantum mechanics. Yeah. That's what I'm actually claiming here is that this is not diffusion. This is not quantum mechanics. It's just diffusion. There is no way you can get quantum mechanics from this. Why? Because you don't have enough degrees of freedom. Okay. You just have rho. Rho is the only field that actually has some dynamics here. There is nothing else. So what we need to do, if we want to hope to get quantum mechanics, is we need to find in this theory here an additional degree of freedom. And the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to say, well, look, when you diffuse in this space, as long as this space here is itself fixed, as long as that space is not doing anything, there is no additional degrees of freedom in the theory, just pure diffusion. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to allow the geometry of that space to change. That conformal factor that appears in the Gaussians, I'm going to allow that guy there to also be able to change in time. I need to generalize this. Otherwise, there is no quantum mechanics. So the wave function requires 2 degrees of freedom, and so I'm going to use that phi, that was the function that appeared in the gradient of the current velocity, I'm going to claim this is a good candidate phase. I don't know this. I'm just going to try it and see what I get. I'm going to allow the configuration space to become itself dynamical, a space that can react and have its own dynamics. So the question that arises here is, this is, at least it's an independent degree of freedom because these guys are now separate degrees of freedom. What? Yeah? Rho is just the rho that was diffusing before, like this one, right? And now I'm going to allow this configuration space to itself.
So big phi of x those big 5x
conversations that are... No. Oh, yes. Exactly. And that, what that means is that these Gaussians that were originally fixed, now they can actually change their variance. Pardon me? It's time dependent. And that implies that the entropy itself is time dependent and that this phi function is also time dependent. Okay. Now, Yes. It turns out to be consistent. Yes. Of course, now when you do the Fokker-Planck equation and all of those, you have to make sure that your drift velocities, those b's, are all now time dependent, and everything now becomes time dependent. But what is the dynamics of this manifold? So I have to make an assumption here. All right. I would wish I could do this from first principles, but I can't at this point. So I'm going to make the assumption that energy is conserved. And this is clearly something that I'm pulling out of nowhere, because energy, you were just talking about statistical inference. Well, what is energy there? Well, the idea is original. The math I'm going to borrow from a paper by Nelson and Smalling in 2006. The idea is that if we want an energy conservation, we have to stipulate a form of energy. And what Smalling suggested in 2006 was that for non-relativistic or low-velocity limits, you are going to have one term in one of the velocities, the current velocity, another term in the other velocity. You may have a potential. You're going to have coefficients. And once you work on this a little bit, you see that this coefficient here, you see there are squares, so the metric tensor enters in there. This coefficient m is related to sigma squared, and there is another constant there. I can put the arbitrary constants that appear here, I can write them in various ways, but there is another constant there that's supposed to relate the units of mass with the units of time and distance. This mass here is what will turn out to be the regular mass of the particle, the inertial mass. And this is something that appears as a coefficient in the osmotic velocity squared. So I call it the osmotic mass. So just two independent coefficients there. The result of imposing that this energy V, that rho evolves according to the diffusion equation, the Fokker-Planck equation, the conservation of continuity equation, and that this E is actually conserved, is two coupled equations. First, the continuity equation. The continuity equation tells you how rho evolves given the geometry of the configuration space. And there is an energy conservation equation that tells you how the geometry of the configuration space evolves given the distribution of rho. So the two are coupled. And this is it. Now that we have written something, the challenge is to read what it is that we have written. The dynamics now is completely defined. But it's finished. Now let's extract some juice. We can always combine rho and phi into a complex number. Let's do that. When I do that, what I get is something that smells like the Schrödinger equation, where eta, Greek h, plays the role of h bar. So this is looking in the right direction. But there is some junk left over. All right? Now, let's look at the junk. First, because it's very interesting how the junk manifests itself. The theory is finished. I'm not going to cheat you anymore, okay? The assumptions are all done. This is it. So this is my theory. If it doesn't look like quantum mechanics, it's because maybe it isn't quantum mechanics, or maybe it is quantum mechanics, but it's hiding. First, notice that there were those two masses there, the osmotic mass and the inertial mass. When h goes to zero, a sort of classical limit, this term disappears And what you end up having is well, the usual Econal equation and all of that. So it's actually not difficult to see that when H goes to zero, this guy here behaves like the inertial mass. So that, Oh, Greek H, eta, Greek H, yes. Now notice this, it's nonlinear. There are all sorts of experimental reasons why you want to avoid nonlinearities in quantum mechanics. Quite apart from the fact that if you measure, you don't find them. If you have them, you could send signals faster than the speed of light. There are all sorts of reasons why you wouldn't want them. There are theoretical reasons as well why you wouldn't want those things. So maybe you could say that experiment tells you that mu equals m, in which case we derive quantum mechanics. But they can do much better than that. There is a related question. So one is the nonlinearity here. We don't want that. There is a related question which addresses the issue of why complex numbers. Why can we say that complex numbers are so crucial in quantum mechanics? Well, complex numbers can be said to be crucial in quantum mechanics because you can write an equation that, well, let me say it differently. Given rho and phi, I can always combine them into a psi. And of course, you can always combine those two equations into an equation that includes not just psi, but also psi star. So the statement that quantum mechanics, that complex numbers in quantum mechanics play a very special role, is the statement that the Schrödinger equation includes only psi, not psi and psi star. Of course, it includes both. You can always make it include both, and that means that you have replaced real and imaginary part by just z and z star or something. So the issue of why complex numbers are crucial in quantum mechanics is also associated to the equality of osmotic and inertial mass. The two are the nonlinearity of quantum mechanics, of this theory, and the role of complex numbers are both associated to the same problem.
This is another interesting variable.
Yes. Yes. You do. Yes, that's correct. So the question that arises here is, why should mu equals m? Well, the interesting thing is that in doing all of this, I have introduced various little constants there that have to do with choices of units. So we can always regraduate to a more convenient description by changing the units of this constant here that related mass to energy and time. And the units of the of time, we can always change them in this way. And I can invent a new phase factor going with a new different wave function, in which has been regraduated in that way. You see, I'm just changing units here. I'm not doing anything else shaking. But the new wave function is different from the old one, right? Because there is an additional kappa there. So what happens if I do that? Well, what happens when I do that is that I get a Schrödinger equation with the new rescaled eta prime for the new wave function, plus the Yaki term. And the Yaki term is very much like I would expect before, except that what appears here is mu kappa squared. Now you see what the trick is. All of these theories with different kappas, kappa equals 1 is the one in the previous slide. This is with a different value of kappa. All of these theories are physically completely equivalent. I haven't done anything. I just have relabeled things. But nothing prevents me from choosing of all of these theories that are completely equivalent, that give me exactly the same physical predictions, choosing the value of kappa that will make this term disappear. From this point of view, Complex numbers are not particularly fundamental in quantum mechanics. They are just a more convenient way to do your inferences. They lead to a nicer theory. Same thing with Hilbert spaces. If you have those nonlinearities there, then you wouldn't even want to talk about superposition principles or Hilbert spaces or anything of the sort. They would just not be convenient. So there is an element here in which the Hilbert spaces, the linearity of time evolution, the complex numbers are all among a series of equally, well, physically equivalent possibilities. They are the most convenient one, and that's the one we choose.
But when you play around with your eta, are you not playing around with your eta?
You're changing the eta prime. Yes. Now, okay. The eta, which is Planck's constant? It's the value of eta prime for that particular kappa that makes that term disappear. This is the equation that defines what h bar is going to be. Planck's constant, the one you actually measure experimentally. Yeah.
So if all those theories are equivalent physically,
yeah.
Does that mean you found a class of nonlinear theories which have no signaling, because quantum mechanics has no signaling?
I would think so. Okay, I hadn't thought about that, but yes. But they're completely equivalent. It's a little bit like when you're talking about degrees of belief, probabilities are supposed to obey something like this. But nothing prevents you from talking about degrees of belief. One half two. Nothing prevents you from talking about degrees of belief that are defined in this way. You can go ahead and say, my belief is described by these numbers f. And these numbers f are such that it is the sum of their squares that equals to 1. And these are degrees of belief. Now, unfortunately, these degrees of belief are not particularly convenient. Why? Because they're not easily connected with frequencies, maybe. Or right? Probabilities have a nice connection with frequencies in asymptotic limits and all of that. But you can do that. In the same way here, those wave functions that are defined in such a way that there are additional awful terms, you could call them wave functions, but they're not convenient. They're yucky. They
if I solve a linear equation,
yeah.
Then it comes from the linear. I don't get a solution of a nonlinear equation.
If you solve the linear equation
and then
from the linear equation, you compute rho. And from the linear equation that has a particular phi prime, you compute the phi. Then the new phi with the new phase, of course, is not going to solve the linear equation. It's going to be a mess. But all the physics is in the rho. All the physics is there. What is the probability of finding the particle there? Yeah. Well, of course, but I'm in the business of deriving quantum mechanics, and so all of that was to say. Say that again.
You said that all these theories are equivalent.
Yeah.
But in that the choice of cap is arbitrary.
Yeah.
Okay, so then is there something requiring us to choose the cap that gets rid of that? Or could I just say, well, I'm just going to be lenient and choose a different cap?
Yeah, you can. And then you're going to have to.
Then you make the same. So then I'm making the same prediction as quantum mechanics in the nonlinear theory.
Yeah.
So now you're saying quantum mechanics really doesn't have just the Schrodinger equation, it has this whole class of equations.
But you see, I think that's sort of trivial. Suppose that you take a wave function that describes the ground state, not the ground state, any state in the hydrogen atom, and you compute what the these things are. Now I invent a different wave function in which I did something wacky. Now, of course, this function is going to satisfy an awful equation. But it's not telling you anything new. There is no physics.
Well,
yeah, the rho does not depend on that. Yeah. Okay, I'm really running out of time, so let me tell you the conclusions. There is a gravitational equivalence principle that says that we accept the equivalence of gravitational forces with the fictitious forces that arise in accelerated frames, because there is a reason we accept that. You get a lot in return, because it explains the equality of inertial and gravitational masses. This is what made Einstein pursue this path. And ultimately, you accept the equivalence of gravity with fictitious forces, because it allows a geometrical explanation of gravity. Well, something analogous is happening here, a kind of quantum equivalence principle. The first person to point out to the possibility that this was actually possible was Lee Smolin. He did this in, sometime in the 90s. We accept the equivalence of quantum and inferential probabilities. There is a strong movement out there to say that there are classical probabilities and there are quantum probabilities, and that they're separate things. From this point of view, there is only one kind of inference. You process information to update from prior beliefs to posterior beliefs. Only one way to do it, and we accept the equivalence of this, of whatever you might, I don't even want to mention quantum probabilities, only one, right? Because it explains the equality of inertial and osmotic masses. You can always choose the osmotic mass to be the same. It also explains the linearity of time evolution, the superpositions that you're going to get when your time evolution is linear, and the presence of complex numbers, the particularly good role that complex numbers play in quantum mechanics. And of course, ultimately, I like it because it allows an inferential explanation of quantum theory. Final remarks. Now, this is all very provisional. This is non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So there are a number of things that one should be cautious. On epistemology versus ontology, this has to do with whether you're dealing with the space of X's, the space of probability distributions, or physical space, whatever that might be. Ontology is something that would happen here if I knew what that was. Epistemology, beliefs, opinions, information, is something that happens here. All the dynamics is happening here. So this is very epistemological. In that sense, Bohr and Heisenberg and those guys, they got it right. Now, they didn't have the tools to do quantitative epistemology like we do today, but they got it right. And part of the confusion in their approach was that they couldn't talk about degrees of belief. Now, the laws of physics are appearing at this level. This is where the Schrödinger equation appears. While laws of ultimate nature, or whatever that might be, would be something that appears there. Now, of course, once I tell you what X is, that gives you a very good idea what the Y is going to be. It's in the neighborhood, right? So this has information about reality. But it is indirect. It's a little bit indirect. The laws of physics are a little bit more removed from reality. On dynamical laws, entropic inference gives you law without law. This is not a law of physics. This is laws of inference. Although it is true, I had to cheat and use energy conservation. I'm sorry. On mass and phase, mass ended up being, except for constants, a very statistical quantity, something that has to do with uncertainty. The phase, too, entropies, rows. So mass and phase are also interpreted as statistical objects. Now, this is what Wheeler would have referred, just like he would refer to something like this as law without law. This is what Wheeler would have said, is substance without substance. Mass has to do with jiggling. Now, this is actually not unreasonable. Mass in physics is something that we associate with the Zitterbewegung of particles. In the Weinberg-Salam model, a particle acquires mass by virtue of being initially massless, and the right-handed components propagate until they get scattered into the left-handed components, and then they propagate again, and so on. And so it is this scattering back and forth of left and right-handed helicities that gives is what we call mass. So the fact that there are uncertainties, that mass is associated with uncertainty, is something to be expected. Now, the fact that phases of the wave functions are associated with statistical objects, this is very new, and this is where there is a good chance that the theory will hurt, right? Where, in all of this, where am I worried that this theory might not work? It's here, because this is a new statement, and it's only when you repeat the statements of the masters, then the chances that even if you mispronounce them, the things are going to come out right are very likely, right? A good chances. But when you say something new, that's when you really are sticking your head out and you can really make mistakes. So this is where things can go wrong. Well, okay. There are objections to stochastic mechanics of Nelson by Wallström. Unfortunately, I managed, this bypasses those objections. But the fact that I have a phase that is associated and given by a formula makes me uneasy, because I don't know how to incorporate gauge transformations here. Now, that doesn't mean, you see, there is a big distinction between saying, I have worked on this for the last 10 years and I have failed. Then it would be a real problem. The statement I want to make is, I have worked on this for about 2 months now. This is when I got these results. And I still do not know how to include gauge transformations. Now, I do not know how to include gauge transformations, which would definitely bear on this issue. I also do not know how to include Galilean transformations, changes of reference. I also do not know how to include more general changes of frame, which would be important to do relativity. I also do not know how to justify in a more deeper way that choice of energy. And I think that all of these subjects are very, very intimately connected. But this is where I don't know whether the whole theory is going to hold water or not. In any case, this is kind of nice. I think that there is something to it. Thank you. I'm so sorry I took so much. There are no questions, no time for questions.